one hand, he had been, you know, a very productive member of society. He had done a lot of good things, apparently did his job very well. On the other hand, he obtained that job in the first place by lying.
An unusual case of identity theft ends in a federal prison sentence. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, August 25th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, concern over the long-term impacts of the actions of Murkowski's former fisheries aide.
If people say, well, you can't trust them because they're all cheaters and crooks, it undermines the whole model of fishery management in the U.S.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
A man in an unusual case of identity theft was sentenced in federal court in Anchorage today. Rafael Mora Lopez had lived in Anchorage for more than two decades as Rafael Alberto Espinoza. Mora Lopez had been a police officer in Anchorage for 6 years before he was arrested in April for living in the U.S. illegally under a stolen identity. Tom Bradley is an assistant U.S. attorney in the criminal division of the Anchorage office. Mora Lopez had faced a maximum sentence of 13 years and $250,000 in fines. Bradley says today's sentence of 3 months in federal prison and a $10,000 fine is fair.
As the judge said, he's attempting to promote respect for the law and punish Mr. Mora Lopez for his criminal activities.
Bradley says Mora Lopez will be sent to a facility outside of Alaska because there are no federal prisons in the state. After he completes his sentence, he could be deported. But Bradley says he can appear before an immigration judge to seek permission to stay.
If he's not successful there, he can appeal that to the Board of Immigration Appeals and eventually the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. So it's probably not something that would be resolved one way or the other in the near future.
Bradley says it's very unusual for someone who has committed identity theft to go into a high-profile position, such as a police officer.
It cuts both ways, because on one hand, he had been a very productive member of society. He had done a lot of good things, apparently did his job very well. On the other hand, he obtained that job in the first place by lying, and he, in a sense, never should have been in that position.
Mora Lopez had pleaded guilty in June to passport fraud and false claims of U.S. citizenship. A pilot station man is dead after a 32-foot tender he was piloting flipped over in the Yukon River. KYUK's Shane Iverson has more from Bethel.
Alaska State Troopers are reporting the pilot is 23-year-old Gerald Richardson Minock. They say he was the only one on board when the boat turned upside down sometime Tuesday night or more likely early Wednesday morning. The tender was found by a trooper caravan at about 10:40 on Wednesday morning. It was 4 miles below its destination. The boat belongs to Boreal Fisheries, a small-scale fish buyer operating out of St. Mary's in the Lower River. The tender was headed towards the fish buyer's dock. About 10 volunteer boats filled with 30 searchers began searching for Minock. Early that Wednesday afternoon, two hunters below Mountain Village located his body floating in the Yukon waters. Minock was wearing a life jacket. Troopers say there were no obvious signs of trauma, and alcohol does not appear to be a factor in the incident. An initial investigation by troopers is indicating that the tender was overloaded with fish. Troopers say they talked with a fisherman who observed the boat just a few inches above water. Weather conditions at the time were windy and rainy. Minock's body will be sent into the state medical examiner's office in Anchorage for an autopsy. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
The admission this month by a Senate staffer that he's guilty of illegal fishing in Alaska is creating greater impact than just one man's future. Arnie Fugelvog was an aide to Senator Lisa Murkowski for 5 years. He was a local Petersburg fisherman who was considered a top expert in the U.S. Senate on fisheries policy. Now some of the Alaskan issues he promoted are under extra scrutiny. APRN's Libby Casey reports from Washington.
The news that Arne Fugelvog lied about where he caught fish surprised those who watched the industry.
I was actually quite stunned.
Gunnar Knapp studies the seafood industry as a professor of economics at the University of Alaska Anchorage Institute of Social and Economic Research.
At first, I understood, well, there was some fisheries violation, and those are, you know, fairly common, but then it turned out it was a substantial and significant fisheries violation and a jail term and so on. And it was quite a shock, just personally.
It's not like Fugelvog accidentally caught a few fish over some confusing boundary. The plea deal says he falsified records of his catches over years, and as punishment, he faces 10 months in prison and $150,000 in penalties. And that's the deal he got. But it's more than a staffer with a checkered past, says John Sacton, who founded Seafood.com News.
The problem is most people in Congress know nothing about fisheries. And this is why I called Arne to be one of the most important fisheries staffers in Washington.
Fugelvog had credibility because he was a fisherman. He was also respected on Capitol Hill for putting in long hours, digging into dense policy, and not getting caught up in the heady world of D.C. politics. Both he and John Sacton are supporters of the individual fishing quota, or catch share systems, used in Alaska's federally managed fisheries. Scientists set a limit of what can be caught, and fishermen get a percentage. It's controversial because as the fishery is divided up, there are always winners and losers. But advocates say it's the way to sustain fisheries and fishermen's livelihoods. Here's Arne Fugelvog on APRN 3 years ago explaining why he supports catch shares.
Some might disagree with me. Some would say, yeah, but they're telling you can only catch this much fish. And before you could catch as much as you want, and that's really the biggest change. But the days of just going out and fishing endlessly and catching as much as you want, they're gone. They're gone.
Except that's what Fugelvog admits to doing, fishing what he wanted where he wanted. John Sacton says the blow is having one of CatchShare's most visible champions busted.
Arne was in this position. He was both a fisherman and he was a public policy person, and then he went on to work for Murkowski. So he, of all people, in my opinion, should have known what the repercussions were for falsifying catch records and so forth. So I personally feel betrayed.
Sacton worries this diminishes the credibility of a unique system in which the fishermen have a say in setting policy.
If people say, well, you can't trust them because they're all cheaters and crooks, it undermines the whole model of fishery management in the U.S.
There's a roiling debate in the nation right now over whether Alaska's model of catch shares should be used in other places like New England. And legislation is expected in Congress to bar spending money on catch share programs in the Atlantic and anywhere else for that matter, including Alaska. Defunding oceans policy isn't expected to get anywhere, but it's fights like these that concern the United Fishermen of Alaska, which represents more than 30 commercial fishing industry groups. It supported Arne Fugelvog over the years, but now President Arne Thompson says this could do major damage.
This is a real slap in the face. It's a discredit system and actually it gives fodder to those who oppose quota share systems to further request that there be no new quota share systems, and there's a lot of that sort of anti-quota share system activity going on the East Coast.
Thompson is also worried this could discourage other fishermen from stepping up and volunteering for regulatory boards and positions.
Regardless of whether or not you're a credible, honest individual, you still come under criticism when you accept these public positions. Also, they're very demanding, can quite often require a lot of hours of volunteer time.
Economics professor Gunnar Knapp says it will be months before it's clear whether Fugelvog's fall will alter the debate over catch shares and fishing policy.
The implications are potentially very big, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they will be very big. It's possible that it will play out as a particular incident that people don't necessarily generalize or assume that all fishermen are that way or that it necessarily reflects badly on those particular types of policies. So I think we need to wait and find out, and looking back, we'll be able to see how much influence it had, but it could have a significant effect.
Arnie Fugelbaugh's plea deal includes an addendum, which says he could get a reduced sentence if he gives authorities information. It's sealed and not yet public, so who knows whether others in the fishing industry could be implicated, which would expand the ripples of influence wider. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
National Public Radio is reporting that Anchorage-based polar bear scientist Chuck Monette is expected to report back to work tomorrow, but his job will be changing and he will no longer manage federal contracts. Monette was suspended more than a month ago by the Bureau of Ocean Management, Regulation, and Enforcement. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, archaeologists make a remarkably well-preserved discovery near Barrow.
The individual actually still had clothes, which hasn't typically been the case. They've usually been pretty much skeletons by the time we found them.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Last Sunday, an Anchorage cab driver was arrested by police and charged with sexual assault. Now the Anchorage police say more women have come forward with similar accusations against the man. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Often following a sexual assault arrest, the police issue a public request for other possible victims of the charge to come forward. It doesn't always work. In this case, Anchorage Police Department spokesperson Lieutenant Dave Parker says, it did.
They have had multiple individuals come forward with accusations against the same cab driver.
According to the charges, Chittaberry Unwokeri, 43, offered the woman a free ride to look for a cell phone battery. He then allegedly took her to the yellow cab service yard where the victim says he sexually assaulted her. Shortly afterwards, a passing motorist spotted her.
A woman had been picked up along Ship Creek Avenue with her clothing in her hand, her pants in her hand. She was trying to get away from a cab driver who she told the man who stopped to assist had sexually assaulted her.
The motorist was a member of the military who had just left the base shooting range and was taking his weapons to a nearby storage facility. Shortly after the woman got into his car, the cab driver appeared.
The military man stepped out with a firearm and held the suspect for police. We arrived and began working the case, believed an arrest was in order. Cab driver was arrested and taken down for bail hearing and then taken to jail.
At Sunday's bail hearing, Magistrate James Stanley set Unwokeri's bail at $5,000 or a surety bond without a third-party custodian. The low amount and quick release has produced considerable public anger, as well as statements from the organization Standing Together Against Rape. Stanley is a new magistrate who began his duties last month. Previously, he'd practiced mostly civil law in Anchorage for about 30 years. Parker says alcohol was not a factor in the Sunday assault.
No indication at all. The victim had not been drinking, and there's no indication that the cab driver was either.
The spokesman also praised the women who have contacted the police in the case.
Because we need victims of sexual assault not to be ashamed, not to be hesitant, not to blame themselves like is so often the case, but to come forward and allow us to go after the bad guy.
Parker says right now the new accusations are being investigated by the police. If and when the detectives feel they have sufficient evidence, they'll take the new case or cases to the district attorney for additional charges and another bail hearing. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Nearly half of Alaska schools showed adequate yearly progress in the latest results of testing, but 275 did not. Many are familiar with not meeting AYP. One school has not met the standard in 8 years. In extreme cases, the state will take over school control in a failing district. Last summer, the state intervened in the Upi school district and began a multi-year plan for the three schools in the district. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Legislative hearings in February pointed out friction in the working relationship between the school district and the Department of Education. Legislators were told there was not true dialogue between state and local people, and the district did not feel it was being included when decisions were made. 6 months later, Bethel Representative Bob Heron says the relationship could still be better. He says the process and the results of the intervention are still not defined to his satisfaction.
I'll be polite. I'm extremely disappointed in the department's attitude, and I'm going to continue to work and kick their butts that they need to change their approach to my school district.
Heron says he's looking for a cooperative management style, not a top-down approach that avoids responsibility for the outcome. Heron says the department must admit that the process being used in UPEAT isn't working. The Department of Education, though, sees positive results. Deputy Commissioner Les Moore says the first steps have taken place, and the three-year goal is to put support in place for the district itself to carry on. And he says the district has reached out and the state has listened. For example, with the state following the district's ideas on improving how students learn to read.
They're engaging our people that are supporting them and trying to make sure that we're working together. And so that's what I see is the people on the ground doing the work, the teachers, the principals, and our coaches that go out and work there are working together.
UPEAT Superintendent Howard Diamond says he's still concerned that the state trustee, part of the intervention team, does not collaborate with the district before decisions are made. He says the state is looking only at numbers, the result of one annual test. But the school district is looking at improving all the root causes of why schools fail the tests. Teachers, parents, the community, and the students themselves.
Our communities are going through a wellness journey, and they are looking at improving the entire community. They're talking about improving their families and their schools and how they relate to each other. And during this wellness journey, we are a part of it, and we are very happy to be a part of it because we feel as the communities improve, as the families start to take more interest in their students' success in school, as a byproduct, test scores will improve.
Diamond says success will not be measured in a test score. He and the school district are looking for systemic changes that will be seen many years from now. Moore says even the federal government sees the goals of the No Child Left Behind program as unrealistic. Those call for 100% proficiency in every school by 2014. Moore says the state is happy with a consistent, reasonable improvement. The department is putting a lot of support efforts into two districts, Lower Yukon and Yukon Flats. But he says the state is stepping back from its level of involvement with the Northwest Arctic District because improvements have been made.
So there's a lot of districts in a lot of different varying places in terms of the support that we provide to them, all with the same ultimate goal of improving achievement.
Representative Heron recommends the Department of Education reevaluate the work going on in UPEAT in light of success elsewhere. And he recommends the local educators have more of a say in their future. He says change has to be made across the board, not just locally. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Archaeologists in Barrow have begun to use ground-penetrating radar as a way to detect burial sites beneath the tundra. Though it is a relatively untested technique in the Arctic, it shows some promising results. APRN's Josh Edge has the story.
When UIC Sciences senior scientist Ann Jensen decided to team up with Radford University's Rhett Herman to bring up the ground-penetrating radar, or GPR system, no one was really sure how well it would work. Not even the manufacturer knew how accurate the system was going to be in the mostly unconsolidated gravel lying on top of a layer of permafrost that makes up much of the geology in the area. According to Jensen, it turns out that the GPR didn't work very well in areas that had seen frequent vehicle traffic. Evidence of the compacted road surface could be observed up to 2 meters below the surface, hindering the GPR's ability to see grave sites. But once the crew got a little ways off the beaten track, that story changed.
And there, it actually was working much better. Unfortunately, that was right at the end of their stay and the rather short field season we had this year. But there, it actually did find a grave. And this was a very deeply buried grave, the most deeply buried that we've recovered. And in fact, so deeply buried that it's not clear that we would have been able to detect it with normal testing procedures, because it's just hard to dig a really decent shovel test to a meter and a half in loose gravel.
Jensen says that this burial was actually much better preserved than the more shallow burials she's worked on.
The individual actually still had clothes, which hasn't typically been the case. They've usually been pretty much skeletons by the time we found them, because they're not permanently frozen at the point, unlike, for example, in town in Barrow, where, you know, people just basically freeze and sort of are more freeze-dried, if you will.
Though they've found the body, Jensen says some cultural considerations will need to be addressed before more work can be done.
It's wearing a parka, which is in really fragile condition. We want to, you know, we need to have the discussion with the community about whether they want to try to preserve the parka. If so, we need to try to get some funds to do that. And we don't want to start trying to take them out of the parka until we have the physical anthropologist here, because, you know, at that point, we'd like to have him study, take his measurements, and then put the person right into the box.
Jensen says the body won't leave Barrow as people study it. And once studies are complete, a service will be held and the body will be reburied.
They make them very nice plywood boxes. We get them nice, dignified, usually polyester, yeah, not polyester, but, you know, fleece, nice warm cloth. Most of them had caribou or some kind of fur under them, but that's just prohibitive to get that much good caribou fur. You know, people kind of need it for modern use. So, and anyway, it doesn't last that long. So it seemed like, you know, nice thick fleece would last as longer.
According to Jensen, studies such as this one in the Arctic have become even more important because of the changing climate. Coastal erosion and changing of the permafrost layer have added to the sense of urgency.
All these Arctic archaeological sites that have wonderful organic preservation, everything is preserved, you know, the skins, the hide, the wood, the, you know, everything. It's not going to be. It's going to be more like Nuuk, where you have partial preservation, where, you know, the human remains are skeletons as opposed to, you know, sort of freeze-dried. And those haven't been thawed that long, I don't think.
Jensen says that though the GPR only found one new burial site this season, she believes there are probably more graves in the area. With help from APRN's Patrick Yak in Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Two Alaska Airlines pilots are being recognized for safely handling a jet last year after one of its engines exploded while taking off from Sitka. Captain Steve Cleary and First Officer Michael Hendricks won the Superior Airmanship Award from the Airline Pilots Association last week. Cleary and Hendricks were at the Boeing 737's controls on August 8, 2010. Association spokeswoman Jennifer Sutton says there was little room for error at Sitka's Island Airport with ocean waters at the end of the runway.
As they started to accelerate down the runway, they hit it about 100 knots, and they saw an eagle flash past the plane directly in the path ahead. And just mere seconds later, when they hit about 130 knots, which is the equivalent of about 150 miles an hour, the eagle smashed into the left engine, causing the engine to explode and burst into flames.
With one engine gone and one going full throttle, the pilots struggled to maintain control, but they were able to stop the jet before it veered off the runway or went into the water.
The really amazing thing here is that while this could have had a tragic ending, the procedures that they took that day and just the swift, clear-thinking action that both pilots exhibited resulted in an event where there were no injuries to any of the 134 passengers or five crew members on board.
The pilots were not available for comment. Only one other crew received the annual award from the association, the world's largest pilots union. It was presented August 18th at the 57th Air Safety Forum Awards Banquet in Washington, D.C. Golden Valley Electric's plan to buy and restart the Healy Clean Coal Plant drew attention at a utility board meeting Monday night in Fairbanks. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The GVEA board wasn't even scheduled to take any action during the meeting on the utility's plan to buy and restart the facility known as the Healy Clean Coal Project Power Plant. But that didn't stop a couple of dozen people from telling board members what they thought about the plan to restart the 50-megawatt plant that's been mothballed for 11 years now, since it failed in tests to function as designed and its way over budget $400 million price tag. Most at Monday's meeting spoke in favor of the project, saying they agree with GVEA's contention that it will bring down electricity costs and provide power to promote economic growth and job creation. But a half dozen others disagreed, like Nancy Kuhn, spokeswoman for GVEA Ratepayers Alliance, who says that despite the image created by the facility's name,
coal is dirty. It is not clean.
And although GVEA plans to burn a type of low-sulfur coal in the plant, Kuhn says it will still create hazardous byproducts like mercury and arsenic. Kuhn says the Ratepayers Alliance doesn't think firing up another coal plant next to an older GVEA plant in Healy is worth the environmental trade-off. She says that the group's members believe that renewable energy sources also can hold down electricity costs, but the members also acknowledge it may cost more to generate electricity using renewables.
In fact, I think many of us would feel that we're more than willing to pay more for the long-term safety of our planet.
GVEA President Brian Newton said during a break in the meeting that using the new Healy facility could reduce the utility's overall emissions by enabling GVEA to use its older, dirtier power plants less. Regardless, Newton says the board already has committed GVEA to the project when, in 2009, it accepted the state's offer to buy the plant for $50 million, with financing provided by the state, along with another $45 million state loan to retool the plant so that it will function. Newton says he believes the turnout at the meeting and the concerns expressed recently online and in media coverage have been generated by the State Department of Environmental Conservation's decision to take additional public comments on the HCC plant proposal through next Monday. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel, Len Anderson in Anchorage, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Josh Edge from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
And by
the Renewable Energy Alaska Project, celebrating 7 years of educating Alaskans on clean, local, sustainable, renewable energy. Find out more online at realaska.org. A PFD reminder, check the status of your 2011 PFD application with My PFD Info online at pfd.alaska.gov. You can view or change your voluntary deductions until Wednesday, August 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
You can find APRN headlines from around the state online at alaskapublic.org. There you'll discover local and worldwide news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.